You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
You're tuned in to WKCR 89.9 FM New York, and this is a production of the Arts Department. Some of our faithful listeners may remember a few weeks ago, we played some of the works of Gertrude Stein from that Folkways Records recording in honor of Triple Canopy's marathon reading of Gertrude Stein. And after a few tweets, we got some of the members of Triple Canopy here in the studio to discuss some of what they're doing in general and some of what they're doing with that marathon reading. So we're going to start off and just want to say thank you guys for joining us this evening. And if you guys could give a quick rundown of who you are and how you each came to Triple Canopy, and for our listeners who don't know what Triple Canopy is.
I'm Sam. I'm a senior editor of Triple Canopy, and I was there when it started about 5 years ago. We began as sort of an online arts and literary cultural magazine. But over the last 5 years, we've done a lot more book publishing, increasingly elaborate public programming. We've had art shows at a space that we have in Greenpoint. We've sometimes been an artist in kind of art contexts and just a whole range of things. So at this point, sort of something else, but we also still put out an online magazine at canopycanopycanopy.com. And Lucy and Dan joined a few years ago.
Hi, I'm Lucy Ives. I'm a deputy editor at the magazine. And as Sam was saying, in 2001, I joined. And at that time, Sam and Dan and I worked together on a literary issue of the magazine that's called Counterfactuals. I think it's issue
14.
Yeah.
I'm Dan Weisel, and I joined as a contributing editor at the same time Lucy did in 2011. I also helped with the literary issue, and I've been involved in the Gertrude Stein marathon since we first did it last year.
So why don't you give us a rundown of what this marathon is and sort of how it came about?
Yeah, well, my mom, who moved to New York in the mid-70s, mentioned it at random a few years ago. It's something that happened for about 25 years from 1975 through 2000, just over New Year's, basically, at Paula Cooper Gallery. And it was done by a lot of the Fluxus people, kind of Dick Higgins and Alison Knowles and others, and John Cage was involved. And sometimes they do Finnegan's Wake, but mostly it was Making of Americans, and it took about 2 days. People would go in drunk on New Year's or just as they were wandering around through Soho and so on. But if you kind of look at the list over the years, it's everyone from the downtown New York arts, you know, Philip Glass and David Byrne and dancers and, you know, artists, writers of all kinds. And then it kind of went away. People got older and got tired of it, or Cage died. It just all kinds of things, generational thing. And this book that seems unreadable and kind of we weren't sure what its life was now.
And why Stein? You said, you know, there that you just weren't sure what its life was now, but why was it for you guys important to bring Stein and Making of Americans back?
I mean, I think, so the thing about the Making of Americans, I mean, just for people who aren't familiar with the book, is that it's 925 pages long. It's far and away like her biggest book. And she saw it as kind of her masterwork. I mean, she spent a lot of her life trying to get it published, and it was seen largely kind of as unpublishable. For good reason. I mean, it's a long, extremely repetitive book, which does have a plot, although the actual plot is fairly contained and probably takes, you could distill it to maybe 20 pages, and a lot of it is just kind of examining wordplay and a lot of variations, and Stein is also kind of working out her theory of psychology, which is in there as well. But it is this kind of monolith of modernism, which is it's strange in that it's at the center of a lot of things, but tends to be ignored. I mean, you don't see this book when you're looking at like the history of the American novel of the 20th century. There are certain Stein works that people like and that people remember, and others just kind of get passed over in silence. And that said, it's kind of a tremendously productive book. I mean, since it kind of became available in a bootleg edition in the late 60s, which Dick Higgins from Something Else Press published without anyone's permission. It's kind of got picked up by poets and painters and artists and kind of gained this kind of secondary life that I think people didn't really expect it to have. It has kind of like this actually kind of fantastic tradition. I mean, it's this kind of weirdly central book that I think people tend to forget about. One thing I kind of just came across is that Gertrude Stein became kind of a great friend of Thornton Wilder, and definitely like the third act of Our Town is largely based on his conversations with Stein and his trying to make sense of the making of Americans, which is kind of fantastic that you kind of like have this text which is kind of so familiar as just kind of be boring. Everyone did it in high school, and it's kind of based on this thing that nobody knows. So there are surprises like that all over with the making of Americans. I mean, it's one of these books that kind of pops up in a lot of different rooms.
I think also people who participate in the reading have this experience or you hear them say, and they say to you, "This is such a good book. This is an amazing book," and it's not a book that lends itself to discovery for solitary readers so much. I think because of what Dan is calling its monolithic scale. I think
it doesn't lend itself to solitary readers, and then at the same time, Sam was talking, you know, about how Triple Canopy starts as this arts, literary, cultural magazine, and then suddenly sort of shifts into an artist in its own context, and it's doing these events. And now bringing this back as sort of a running event, why did you guys decide not just to, you know, come back and bring it back once and do a reading of whoever shows up and read it, but to do it year in and year out?
Just the first year we did it, it was just pleasurable for a lot of people in so many different ways. I mean, one thing that was really interesting was, you know, poets would read it like a poem and novelists would find the novel in it. And some people turn it into music. I mean, there's a real kind of, it feels like a long work of minimalism in some ways with this rhythm that sticks in your head and you start talking like it for a week after. And other people just sort of, it was mud to them and they just, but that kind of swimming in language that you can't parse, for 15 minutes at a time is something that's interesting to experience. And, you know, and people came thinking they'd just be there for half an hour and enjoy the novelty of it or hate it or something, and found themselves staying for much longer and returning. And so we thought we wanted to return to it once at least and you know, potentially keep returning to it. We kind of want to decide to do it every year. We're not going to. But you know, we'll come back to it for sure. We might come back to it next year. We might try to figure out something else that is the same but different, or different but the same.
I mean, it's also, one of the things the book is about is repetition in various forms and how, I mean, so the book is kind of about two American families and their kind of archetypal portraits of America as Stein viewed it, which was kind of a strange view of America. But a lot of the book consists of kind of repetition and Stein seeing that everyone kind of behaved in the same way or told these same stories again and again. And Stein kind of made that kind of part of her art to kind of look at this repetition and to see how repetition could be different. And so I for me, I think like the first time we did it, it was there was kind of almost a stunt aspect to see if we can do this, if we can actually read this really long, repetitive book. And the second year, it was, I think the feeling was very different in that we knew we could do it. Like, that's not that hard. You're just going to line up 120 people and then slot them into a schedule and they'll read it. But there's also like kind of a pleasure in repetition and kind of coming back to something and seeing how, I don't know, like it's nice to have an element of ritual to kind of see how the book has changed across a year, kind of as you've changed. And that there's something very nice in coming back to a book. And there's like the old kind of almost kind of corny line by Roland Barthes where he says that whoever doesn't reread books is kind of damned to read the same book over and over and over. which is one of
we may be damning ourselves.
right. But anyway, I think it is interesting to come back to a book and find it actually kind of very different each time. You can't do that with every book. Not every book is strong enough to hold that. But this is one that I think is.
Yeah, that's definitely true. That it's strong enough to bear repeating. It's really fun to start it too, and fun to finish it. So those are reasons to keep reading it, also to finish it.
And it's also a really funny book.
It is really funny.
It's interesting that we keep talking, you know, about it's language that's difficult to parse, and it's really repetitive. And this is sort of sliding a bit to Triple Canopy is releasing a book, corrected slogans, and just in the introduction at the end of the first page and beginning of the second page that Lucy wrote, there's just a few sentences there that I'll read for our listeners. It says, "Language in its ideal form is supple and transparent. Translation between word and concept is instantaneous. Ideally, we say what we mean and think little of doing so, of having done so." And it's sort of interesting there to talk then about, well, first I want to, I guess I'll split this into two sections, about what Stein is doing, because it seems like some of the difficulty with, you know, getting through Making of Americans, with sort of like feeling like it's mud, is this repetition. And what can I parse from seeing the same thing again and again? Am I supposed to read these as iterations of the same idea, or are these actually unique instances of writing? And it seems that is the problem that Corrected Slogans is sort of dealing with, this how do we write, I guess, after and about conceptualism in art and in literature. And what, I guess, I want to start with narrowing it down, do you think is the role of repetition in that, in dealing with sort of the same idea? It seems there's this anxiety all throughout the 20th century, you know, going back to, I guess, at least Benjamin most famously, about, oh no, once we can reproduce things and once there's iterations of things, everything's going to fall apart, which, you know, depending on who you ask, it either did or didn't. But what do you think then is the role? Now we're looking back, Making of Americans is, you know, written at this hot moment of modernism early in the century. What do you think is that, those same paradigms, what are their roles now in the way we write about art or the way we just write?
I think one thing I noticed this year was, I mean, so one of the reasons I think the book seems hard to read is that if you're reading it silently to yourself, you keep losing your place, because a lot of the words seem very similar. And so the latest printing is kind of very poorly printed, and the lines are very close together. So it's very easy to lose your place because a lot of the lines look very similar. And that difficulty in a certain way kind of goes away if it's read aloud, because you're actually hearing the rhythms of the text in a way that you can't actually see the rhythms of the text when you're reading it silently. And when you actually hear the repetition, it actually sounds actually a lot more normal, in that, like, the way we speak does actually have a lot of repetition.
Yeah.
We say the same things again and again. If you've ever, I mean, like as like a conceptual writing project, kind of like just like actually notating what you actually say, as opposed to how you would write that down if you were trying to transcribe it in a legible way. And so the experience of actually kind of hearing the text read to you is in a certain way, like, it's much more realistic, I guess. It's almost as if we're kind of, I mean, so when the way the book was composed is that Gertrude Stein kind of composed aloud, and her partner Alice Toklas kind of dictated it, and then it was typed, and then it was set into a book. And there's something about when you're listening to the book, it's almost as if you're kind of skipping over kind of all the intervening layers between you, the reader, and Gertrude Stein, the writer, and you're kind of hearing the book said. And so it becomes, like, so the book object has kind of been removed.
Yeah.
And you're kind of closer to the text in a certain way, which I kind of gets us around to the idea of corrected slogans, but I will stop there.
Okay. To start with Benjamin for a second, and the mechanical reproduction essay, it seems like when he's writing that, he seems to be saying something like, there's something really good about this reproducibility mm-hmm. thing that's going on, because it's going to free us from a certain way of being spectators of art. So it's going to prevent us from being in thrall in a way that might have negative political repercussions or something like that. I don't have a whole lot to say on that front necessarily. But I think that when we're doing things like Making of Americans, and this will say something about what's going on with corrective slogans, I think we're still dealing with that problem of wanting to be in thrall to the work of art. I mean, that has not gone away for us. But at the same time, we also know about other ways of experiencing art and strange experiences, like having the book object kind of fall away, like what Dan is talking about, or needing other people around us in order to have an experience of viewership or audienceship or whatever it may be, whatever senses are engaged. So in some way, we're going back and forth between those poles and just wondering about the differences between them and what those might mean, I think.
Yeah, and just to maybe back up a tiny bit and just be like the going back to Stein or Esther Pound and being the explainer or the village explainer here. It's corrective slogans is just sort of the what it is a book that is just coming out that kind of collects the evidence of this multi-part thing we did over the past year. There's a show that has been in Denver that's about writing after conceptual art. So it was commissioned for that. We commissioned a few magazine pieces and had a special issue that had old and new Triple Canopy pieces. We had a few symposia, one that was three pairs of poets and artists talking about writing. And then we had a roundtable discussion where poets and artists talked about reading, but kind of after conceptualism. So, you know, does the art object have to exist or does the book have to exist? You know, kind of the most maybe famous conceptual writer now is Kenny Goldsmith, who does these kind of elaborate transcription projects, sort of like what Dan was saying about if you wrote down all the things you actually say and then tried to read them, what would that be? But trying to kind of get into some of the mess of things. And just in the larger kind of Project Triple Canopy, I mean, when we began as an online magazine, partly it was 5 years ago, and it was before people had smartphones or Kindles or iPads, and just the problem of reading on a laptop screen or computer screen, which still exists but is more complicated now because there are friendlier ways of doing it, but it just seemed like a big problem. Like, we could read informationally online, but we didn't know how to look at art or read fiction on our computer screen. Why would you want to do that? So we've kind of been looking at reading repeatedly, but corrected slogans is this kind of particular way of doing that.
Yeah, and maybe trying to think about reading and writing together a little bit more explicitly, I think, than we've done in the past, perhaps.
Does the object need to exist, or does the art object or the book object need to exist? And this is sort of interesting going then back to, you know, that it was a bunch of these Fluxus artists that were originally doing this Stein thing, and then, you know, in that same group of people, you get all these scores that there's always the question, you know, does the Fluxus score actually need to happen for the Fluxus score to be a work of art? And for you guys, it seems there's a certain tension there. There's always this anxiety, it seems, mostly from publications that are used to being in print and value the printed word very highly, that if you're online, you haven't really created the thing. That there's still just this, like, you're floating in whatever space they're conceiving of that doesn't count as real because you can't hold the thing itself, because what you're holding is just sort of the way to the thing, your laptop or your iPad or your smartphone or your desktop or whatever. And we're talking about writing, you know, after conceptualism, and we're an online magazine, but now we're going to put this into a book. Was there a debate there, or wondering how are we going to talk about this as what our name is, as it's an online magazine, but we're going to publish this thing back into an object?
I think that our overall gesture or contribution to the Denver show had four parts, mm-hmm. and this book is only one of them.
Okay.
So the book, it exists as a record of these efforts. It exists as a record of the symposium with artists and poets and this roundtable discussion about reading, and also as a record of a special issue of the online magazine that we made that contains some older pieces from Triple Canopy that were relevant to the show, and then some newer pieces that we commissioned especially for the show. So there was some sense in which everything ending up in a book in the way that it does. Yes, that's in tension with some of the questions that conceptualism raises about reading, you know, where and when you're reading. But I think it's also just it's a convention that in some ways still works.
Yeah.
And I like the idea that we went back there. But if you take a look at the book, it's a bit of a weird book because it's so much referring to these things that happened. And also at the beginning of the book, it doesn't have a table of contents. It has an index, and the index sort of lets you get at all the material that's in there without putting it in very much order for you. So in some ways, I hope at least it lets you get at the feeling of this material as an event still on some level.
And people tend to forget that the printed book is a form of technology, although like it's yeah. 500 years old. It's one of the forms of technology we're most familiar with, and we tend to forget about it kind of existing in that role, although it does. I'm just like computers or phones or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, the slogan for Triple Canopy that was most successful when we got started, that kind of people understood and helped them understand what we were doing, was slow down the internet or something like that. Slowing down the internet. Triple Canopy slows down the internet. And it was sort of predicated on the fact, this idea that somehow the internet moved too fast, and the things that one liked in real life, like in scare quotes, real life, you couldn't have that kind of experience of time on the internet. You needed to kind of carve out a space, and we were trying to do that. But, you know, as we've kind of proceeded, I mean, all that's become a lot more complicated. And, you know, if you're a person who's engaged in the world, you know, you'll read something online, you'll read a book, you'll go to a concert, you'll go to a talk, all these things. And they're not separate, you know, like they're all real life, and yeah. and they're all kind of part of your experience, and you hold them together. There's some coherence for you. So our project now in some ways is saying all these things do hold together. How can we kind of keep these things coherent? So, I mean, Corrective Slogans is online and a book and part of an art show and two live events or 2 days worth of events. And yet they're all the same thing. So actually that's like exactly what we're interested in, that what kind of coherence and can we create?
And also that we can take something, just going back to this, the index again, that we can take this weird kind of anachronistic slice too, so we can have in the index in the F section, like we can have Sam Frank together with Sigmund Freud and Jonathan Franzen, and all of these guys can be kind of in the same space, along with friends and other important topics like that.
It seems like that's what a lot of the anxiety actually about the internet as a place to experience, well, really to experience anything, is that you're getting this place where all of a sudden all of these things that we like normally split into their own little categories, we say, you know, Sigmund Freud goes here, Jonathan Franzen goes here, and Sam Frank goes here, and maybe they're in communication with each other, but they're all in their separate places. That it seems what we're worried about is, you know, oh, well, you have all these tabs open, and all of a sudden all of these things are open at the same time, and they're communicating each other with a way they weren't intended to. And it almost seems to me like it's really just an anxiety about the reversal of sort of who's in charge of those methods of communication, because instead of, you know, you being able to say, no, this object goes in this kind of place, you know, this thing goes in a gallery, and this thing goes in a library, and this thing goes here, that all of a sudden, you know, you can have 25 tabs open, but then you're also playing some game, and you're also reading Triple Canopy, and you're also reading a Sigmund Freud essay.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a funny thing, because I think some people see this as what was formerly the role of literature. So, for example, it used to be that it was the novel that did this kind of work mm-hmm. for us. I mean, maybe in a different way. So if you believe that the literary is that which sort of transgresses these kinds of boundaries, these kinds of categories, then the internet is doing the job of literature. I don't know if that's true, but it's I don't know, maybe Dan can speak to that a little bit.
I mean, I think, I don't know, one of the things about the internet is that it does kind of break down kind of existing hierarchies, although the other thing the internet is kind of increasingly doing, and this is something we've kind of been thinking about at Triple Canopy, is kind of building up new hierarchies of I mean, there was kind of like, especially in the early days of the internet, this rhetoric of the great freedom that everyone would have, that everyone could suddenly be an author and everyone could kind of get their voice out there, which is true in a straightforward sense. But the problem is that there are now kind of hierarchies of attention and who's in charge of kind of directing people to where things are. And so you have kind of, right now you have kind of like large companies that are kind of increasingly dominating the internet, which is strange. And I don't think like 15 years ago anyone would have predicted that, just because like it's very hard to predict kind of where technology is going to go. And so it's an interesting moment to be thinking about, I mean, the role of writing and how we're reading and writing now, and just because of it is this period of flux. I mean, everything's up in the air right now, and I mean, those who say they know how things are going to turn out are wrong.
If what it's doing is sort of drawing all these connections, and there's a fear of this simultaneity, is probably the incorrect word to use here, but I can't think of the other one, so we're going to go with simultaneity, that there seems to be this, you know, we can't carve out a time, so we have to slow it down. And at the same time, the internet has sort of commodified itself precisely by time. Like, how much time does a person spend on this page? You know, what is the act of clicking? How long are they watching this video? And then all of a sudden, they'll decide how much money you can get from a thing for that. And it seems like that, to some extent, is still part of that. You know, we haven't figured out what the internet is, so you have to sell the thing by how long the thing takes.
Right. I mean, I a couple years ago, there was a study looking at like how much people are actually kind of reading, mm-hmm. and the study basically said that the standard kind of adult American saw 100,000 words or read in some way 100,000 words every day, which seems like a high number. But then you actually think about like how much we actually see on the internet. We see a lot of words, but that's two novels worth of words that we're seeing every day, and obviously we're not giving it the same sort of attention. We're giving some of those words a lot of attention. We might be giving some of those words much more attention than we would in our typical novel reading. But that's, I don't know, in a certain sense, like, we don't know how to do that. We don't know how to handle that. And reading is in a weird state right now. We reread more than we ever did before. Though how well we read, I think, is another kind of question entirely.
Yeah, it seems like we're missing that sort of slow development of literary items, you know, poems and novels and various other forms.
I mean, it's there. No, there. It's certainly there. I mean, it's we're in this moment right now where you can kind of read basically, I mean, everything that was published before 1900 is probably on the web in some way or another. This is not perfectly there, but we're getting to that point. There's so much there, but it's kind of finding a way to do that, finding kind of a space for that, and finding.
So the question is like how to limit,
right?
Then?
Right, I think so. I mean, how to, yeah.
Well, it seems like in some ways the response to that was just to create brands. I mean, you had the Long Reads project coming up, but then, you know, that hashtag took off on Twitter to not even mean, oh, this is a thing that's on Long Reads, just right. That it is a long read, and that somehow by my having, you know, tagged this as Long Reads, I'm just saying you should also actually do it. I'm not just letting you know that it's really long, but that you should also take the time to sit with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you kind of look at the different things that harness your attention, like, and that are successful at creating longer engagement, sometimes it's something like Facebook or something that you know highly researches user behavior and kind of keeps tweaking it so that it becomes a stickier page. But then kind of like once you kind of get past, you know, these big companies or the Apple store that is very careful about what they're selling you or Amazon rankings and so on. You know, there are things like long reads or like brain pickings, these kind of like curatorial projects mm-hmm. on the web that are often really dreadful. You know, they're I mean, it's a certain version of
Reader's Digest for the present.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, like one thing we're trying to open up enough space so that like difficult word, like, you know, avant-garde isn't the right word. Maybe difficult isn't always the right word. But you know, like we're trying to work with the most interesting young writers and artists, you know, working today and also with a sense of history so we can go back to Stein and it's meaningful. It's connected to the present and to the work of interesting writers and artists today. And, you know, these things that then we're publishing by these people are often challenging works, and we just want to, you know, have readers, viewers who trust us enough that they'll say, well, there's something here. Maybe I have to engage with my web browser a different way than I'm used to, or maybe I have to read this 7,000-word thing in all caps by James McCourt, who's... you know, been writing for a long time and used to be a writer who's published in The New Yorker, but The New Yorker's moved on, you know, so that's the kind of thing we're fighting for. We're just like anyone else. We want eyeballs, and stickiness.
Yeah. And I also want to say earlier when I used the word development, I think I was also thinking about the way that, styles of reading have a longer history. And in certain contexts, there were rules for how many people should be in a room when you're reading something, or what you should drink, and stuff like that. And obviously, now we're not used to thinking of that way of reading as being very much at hand or close to us culturally. But I think we're willing to even take the thinking about reading there. Sometimes, I mean, with the Making of Americans, for example.
A lot of this has been sort of floating around, you know, this question of reading and writing and how we're reading and writing and where we're reading and writing and sort of what all of those things inform on the practices themselves. And for Triple Canopy, which is sort of operating again in multiple ways as both, you know, this magazine and they're commissioning works and they're creating works. Is that for you guys where you think the model is? I guess the question here is just for what Triple Canopy is doing, or do you think this is sort of just the next progression of what, say, the style of production is going to be, that you're sort of over here as the magazine and over here as commissioning a work and over here as sort of an artist? And, you know, there's that phrase that came up, the expanded field of publication. And I guess for what for you guys does that connote?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of this stuff is out there, of course. I mean, like, even, you know, pop stars get the 360 degree deal where they're also selling soda and, you know, making movies, and that's all kind of, you know, so I mean, the internet often, like, or just the way the economy is working now, that it wants to go that way sometimes, or it makes that possible, you know. And there's a lot of, in the art world, especially, the art world kind of goes anywhere there's a vacuum, and kind of people do really interesting work using that flexibility, and a lot of really terrible work. You know, so I think it's the possibility is already there, and we're just trying to figure out an interesting, ethical, artistically productive way of doing stuff that's kind of out there in society right now. And, you know, sometimes we're fighting battles that are new ones, but a lot of time we're just sort of operating in the same spaces as a lot of other people, but just hopefully doing it better.
Yeah, I think you need time to be a good editor, and you also need certain kinds of experience and awareness of what's going on. So it seems like some of the time Our activities have to do with almost a kind of research-like way of working, and I think that we bring what we've done in one area to bear on what we then go on to do somewhere else. I can't say much more than that, other than it seems like it's important for there to be some level of seriousness about things, about producing more text and producing more content, or at least that's something that we're interested in.
I think one of the things that publishing online kind of brings to light with writing is that, like, when you're online, it's kind of, it's visible that you're, the writing kind of exists in a network, that someone is writing this, that you're reading it, that you're connected by all the wires and the computers between you and the writer. But I think it's kind of making visible something that's kind of always been there, that, like, reading and writing has kind of always been in a network, whether that's been a network of wires or just a network of people, of a community. And I think kind of what we're doing with Triple Canopy right now is kind of making that network and what that kind of does to reading and writing a little bit more explicit, and looking at different ways that, that network can kind of be brought forward. And so we're kind of, so I think, like, a lot of kind of our operating kind of more in public and, like, having more events and bringing people together in different ways is it's part of the same behavior that reading and writing is. It's all, and I think that's, I think, what publication can be. I think it we need to think of it as being kind of more than just letters on a page or a screen, but as a community, I guess.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys for stopping by and talking to us about this. Again, if you want to keep up to date with what Triple Canopy is doing, they're at canopy.com. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks.